I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Support comes from Grady Health Foundation, presenting Move for Grady Saturday, April 27th, featuring a family-friendly bike ride through Atlanta's in-town neighborhoods. There's a ride, run, or walk distance for everyone, benefiting Grady Health System. More at moveforgrady.com.
This is Buried Truths. I'm Hank Klibanoff. So where are we? We're in that momentous first day of the coroner's inquest, and the smoke from the latest bombshell is still drifting around the courtroom. The medical examiner has just rendered his expert opinion that A.C. Hall was shot in the back by white police officers, and no one's disputing it. Many in the courtroom understand that this changes everything. I mean, if you're defending yourself from attack, how could you shoot your attacker in the back? That's self-defense. And if it isn't a case of self-defense, then what is it? The courtroom is segregated. White spectators on the main floor, black spectators in the balcony. You know, it's like To Kill a Mockingbird. Even the lawyers are segregated at the inquest. So far, the witnesses have been white, but that's about to change. Eloise Franklin, the teenage girlfriend of A.C. Hall, is next on the stand. Eloise is 16. She left school in the eighth grade, and she's very light-skinned. People have always noticed this about her. And on this day, she appears very small in this massive, high-ceilinged courtroom, swearing to tell the truth. Now, she's practically surrounded by white men, the coroner, the five members of the coroner's jury, two of the three lawyers, plus all the whites in the gallery on the main floor. This in a town in which racial conditioning governed everything Eloise did. How she walked down the street, which stores she could visit, where she went to school. Did the courtroom intimidate this young girl? Well, I've been in that room, and I don't know how it couldn't. But Eloise didn't falter. She answered every question, and there were dozens of them. She responded in an unperturbed, straightforward manner, even when the questions and the questioners were hostile. Jack Gautier, the prosecutor representing the state, was the first of three lawyers who would interrogate Eloise. Now remember, this is a recreation of that courtroom scene.
Now tell the jury what happened when you got up to the car for school.
My feet was worrying me, and A.C. and I, we stopped and we talked as I rubbed my feet. We were standing up there talking. There was a car came up in the drive. It was the police. And A.C. grabbed me and pushed me out of the light, and he stayed. He was in the back of the place, and there was a colored boy. He was in a car with the police, and he hollered, A.C., here's the police. A.C. tried to get me to go with him, but I didn't run.
Wait a minute. There was a kid in the police car shouting a warning to A.C. Hall? I've taught this case for a number of years to nearly 50 students, and I have to tell you, we're stumped by this. I don't know who this boy was, the one who yelled, A.C., here's the police. We've taken to calling him the ghost. Now, Eloise Franklin appears to be the only person who saw or heard him. She never wavers in her insistence that the ghost wasn't a ghost at all, but a real person in the police car yelling a warning. But we have no evidence that anyone other than Barnett and Doris Hopper were in the back seat of the police car. I have no doubt that Eloise thought she heard something. Maybe she heard one of the police officers yelling, "Freeze! It's the police!" Maybe there was a young person near the scene who knew A.C. and called out a warning to him. We don't know. Each explanation seems more unlikely than the last. Jack Gautier resumes his examination.
All right, what happened after that?
And the police pulled up in the back of the school there. He hopped out of his car and started shooting.
Who got out of the car?
The one who was driving.
Was that a policeman or not?
It was a policeman.
Where did AC go?
AC went up the path.
Did the other policeman do anything, to your knowledge?
When he heard the shots, he hopped out of the car and he started following his partner.
Now, this is interesting. Eloise says both officers got out of the car before they started shooting. But the first witness, Detective Brooks, who was taking statements from everyone on the scene that night, has testified that the officers fired from inside the vehicle.
Do you know how many shots were fired?
3 or 4. That's how many I heard.
Did you later see AC?
Yes. I went out the way we came in. I went down Hazel Street and he was lying up there on the ground.
The prosecutor finishes questioning Eloise. Now Denmark Groover Jr., the white lawyer representing the two policemen, takes the witness. Groover was an extraordinary character in Georgia history. In addition to his law practice, Groover was a prominent state legislator. In 1956, he led the effort that made the Confederate battle emblem part of the state flag of Georgia, where it remained until 2001. He also proposed laws back then to dilute black voting strength. In his day, Groover was a cagey and a canny lawmaker. Legend has it that he arrived at the legislature early every day and read every piece of legislation that was pending. He then worked out amendments or procedures that would either perfect a bill or doom it to defeat, depending on his disposition. His fellow legislators said such bills had been Grooverized. Probably the single most memorable image of Groover as legislator came in 1964. On the last day of the legislative session, the stroke of midnight means that the session is over for the year, that no more legislation can move forward at that point. Debate on a bill that Groover cared about continued hot and heavy as the clock ticked down. Groover went upstairs to the House Gallery, a balcony that overlooks the House Chamber. Then he climbed over the gallery's railing, hanging by one hand and one foot, a good 15 feet above the House floor. He reached out and tried to stop the clock before it struck midnight. The photo of Groover clinging to the rail ran on front pages all over the country. So this man, Denmark Groover, is the man who is questioning Eloise Franklin on the stand. Groover probably imagined that he could unsettle the 16-year-old girl and turn her story upside down. But it didn't quite work out that way, even though he asked Eloise a lot of questions. More than 230 of them.
Well, now, how are you going about resting your feet? Were you sitting down on something, or what were you doing?
AC. He was holding me up.
AC was holding you up?
That's right.
Were you standing on one foot, or was he holding you all the way off the ground?
He wasn't holding me off the ground.
What?
I was standing on one feet.
You were standing on one foot?
That's right.
Groover steers Eloise to an account of the shooting, making his first mention of the ghost.
All right, after the police car got by and this boy hollered, AC, here's the police, they went onto the back of the building. What happened?
AC asked me to run with him. But I was scared and I didn't run. He broke and run.
Did he run past the police car?
That's right.
Came from behind the police car, ran by it on up across that mound of dirt and on out?
No.
Well, tell me how he did it.
Eloise confirms that A.C. Hall sprinted up to the police car and then right past it. After that, she said, Officer Brown slammed on the brakes and the shooting started.
Did you hear the police holler?
No.
Now, other accounts, as we'll hear, maintain that the officers did shout multiple warnings before they started shooting.
Where did he pass that moving police car now when he was running towards Ash Street?
The police was driving slow and he ran. I guess he was running fast enough to pass by them.
And when he went by them, did he get out in front of them and you could see the light shining on him?
Yes, I did.
And then he got to the mound of dirt and they slammed on brakes.
Yes.
Now let's pause for a moment and talk about that mound of dirt. I can't tell you much about it except that it was just that, a mound of dirt. And it was behind the school. A.C. Hall apparently ran up and over it. But the police car chasing him couldn't negotiate the mound, so Officer Brown had to stop. The mound is important because it becomes a kind of landmark in various descriptions of the shooting.
And then he got to the mound of dirt and they slammed on brakes.
Yes.
And the driver jumped out.
Yes.
And started shooting.
That's right.
You didn't hear him holler?
No.
Did you holler when they started shooting?
Yes.
Did you holler at the police, don't shoot?
No.
What did you do? What did you holler?
I hollered, they done killed A.C.
They done killed A.C.
That's right.
Denmark Groover comes back to the ghost. Right or wrong, though, Eloise sticks to her story.
But you are absolutely positive now that the police car passed by you and got on toward Ash Street. Then somebody hollered, A.C., here's the police.
I'm positive.
You're positive of that.
That's right.
And you're positive that it was only after the police car got beyond you and A.C. that A.C. then broke and ran headed toward Ash Street?
That's right.
You are positive of that?
Yes.
And you are positive that the driver of the car got out of his car?
Yes.
Did he start shooting as soon as he got out of his car?
He went for his gun soon as he got out of the car.
By that time, A.C. had gone over the top of the mound, hadn't he?
Yes. And the police had pulled out his pistol and started shooting.
Groover has done some damage, although not quite as much as he'd hoped. The coroner's jury is left to puzzle over the ghost and whether the cops were in the car or out of the car when they opened fire. They may have heard Eloise utter a dubious statement or two, but what they saw was a poised, unwavering young woman who was telling the truth as she understood it. Groover passes the witness to Howard Moore, Jr., the young black attorney from the civil rights law firm in Atlanta. In this exchange, Howard Moore explores the topic of the teenager's shoes. Here's Howard Moore, played by an actor.
I understand that you are in a pathway that leads from the back of Carver School to Ash Street. Is that right?
That's right.
And why did you take this pathway?
Why did I?
Why did you and AC take it?
Because it on the way to my friend girl's house.
And were you wearing shoes?
Yes.
What kind of shoes were you wearing?
Black.
What they call ballerina slippers?
No.
What they call Italian wedge?
No, hard bottoms.
Just hard bottom shoes?
That's right.
Are these the same shoes you are wearing now?
That's right.
Eloise's shoes. Now, why did Howard Moore veer off in this direction? Well, think about it. Eloise had just endured a tough cross-examination by Denmark Groover. So Moore's line of questioning carries no risk for Eloise. By the way, you're not going to find out later that her shoes proved to be critical evidence. They didn't. But they did help the jury to remember that Eloise herself was not just a piece of evidence, but a living, breathing, vulnerable person. This was a county courthouse in the South, the same building where white registrars had and still did routinely humiliate and crush the spirits of blacks trying to register to vote. The county courthouse was the castle in the kingdom of white power in the South. Everyone with a black robe was white. Everyone running around with stacks of court papers was white. Everyone with a gun on their hip was white. And every black person in the building, well, they were in essence just a guest. So think of Moore's tactic this way. Humanize and sympathize. That is, the more humanity he can confer on Eloise, the more sympathy the jury will feel for her. Think about where this pair of black flats had taken Eloise. She and AC had stopped by the school to rest her feet. These were the shoes in which she ran screaming into the street. They done killed AC. She was wearing them when she ran to where AC lay dying a block away. She was wearing them when she ran to the hospital emergency room. and she was wearing them now as she sat in the courtroom and testified.
You love free, and at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Support for WABE's local coverage on maternal health and mortality comes from Georgia Health Initiative, whose mission is to inspire and promote collective action that advances health equity for all Georgians. Learn more at GeorgiaHealthInitiative.org.
Night was starting to fall when the first day of testimony ended, and the five members of the coroner's jury left the courthouse. Who knows what they were thinking about the testimony they had just heard? I've told you that all five jurors were men, and all were white. There are a few other things about them that you might find interesting. Some had little or no schooling, but all could read and write. One ran a plumbing company. One sold insurance. One managed a shoe store. Another managed a fish and oyster company. And another? Well, he was a mayonnaise salesman. These five men ranged in age from 51 to 81. Now this got my attention because you know what it means? That all but one of them was born in the late 1800s. These jurors had experienced a making when all white juries routinely freed white assailants and killers of black men. I'll give you an example. In 1923, over a two-month period, a Ku Klux Klan mob had flogged, brutally beaten, 10 black residents in Macon. It made national news. It was so bad in Macon that the state leader of the Klan had to come to town to help the sheriff get the Macon Klan under control. The sheriff arrested a prominent Macon dentist for the beatings. His name, Alvin C. Yarborough. The sheriff called him the whipping boss. Now, this dentist hadn't hidden his love for the Klan. Anyone visiting his office could see it. When they walked in, all they had to do was look at the walls. They were adorned with large photographs of hooded Klansmen on horseback. Alvin C. Yarborough was also well known for avoiding conviction. In four separate trials for flogging and kidnapping black people, white juries let him walk free four times. Now, 1923 seems like a long time ago, doesn't it? But think of it this way. All of the jurors in the A.C. Hall inquest were adults in 1923, and they knew well this history of Macon, Georgia. So will the case in 1962 be more of that? Well, it's hard to know. Here at the end of the first day, what impact all these factors, race, age, education, occupation, and the racial conditioning of life with the Macon Klan will have on these five jurors. They will have a full day to ponder the first round of testimony. The inquest will resume in 2 days, on Friday, October 19th. The one person I can imagine is devastated at the end of that first day is A.C. Hall's mother, Curly Hall. Howard Morris says she didn't have to sit in the balcony with the other black residents, but instead was permitted to sit right behind him. Now, we've tried to learn as much as we can about her, starting with, her exact name. That's because the court reporter noted that Curly Hall's name was Beatrice. Well, we'd never heard that before, so I went and checked A.C. Hall's birth certificate and his death certificate, and both of them identify his mother as Curly Hall. Well, what if that was wrong? So we looked into her birth certificate and her death certificate. Both say Curly. Curly Kinder when she was born, Curly Hall when she died, not Beatrice. So why did the court reporter write Beatrice? Well, I don't know for sure, but I will tell you this, and this happened a lot in the South in those days. Court reporters, newspaper reporters, were frequently careless in getting the correct names of black people. That first day of testimony in the courtroom had to be so shattering for Curly Hall. AC, her only child, was gone. And remember, this day in the courtroom is just 4 days after her son was killed. And tomorrow, that's going to be even more difficult for Curly Hall. She has to bury her son. The service was held at 4:30 in the afternoon. The church, Trinity CME on Liberty Street, was only a 5-minute walk from the Hall home. The church is small, it's solid, it's red brick, and it has a white steeple. Now, Curly Hall has some support at the funeral. Her mother is with her, and family has arrived from Florida, Michigan, New York. And she'll be joined by friends at this church, the same church that she and AC attended. Curly has been active in the church, serving as secretary, and involved in organizing benefits for groups. Reverend L. H. Welchel officiated at A.C. Hall's service. Reverend Welchel is no longer living, and we've not been able to find the program from the funeral, what was said, what hymns were sung. But each October, for the past 3 years, I've taken my students to Trinity CME Church for services. We've always been received with great love and warmth. The first time we visited in 2016 was a notable occasion for the church. And guess who they invited to deliver the sermon? Reverend L. H. Welchel's son and namesake, also Reverend L. H. Welchel. Our search for the Father had led us to the Son.
What they are doing and...
As a visiting pastor, standing where his father had stood 54 years earlier for the service of A.C. Hall, he welcomes our pursuit of information in the case.
We hope that it will certainly uncover a lot of things that have gone on in our time and before our time, and we're grateful to them for what they are doing.
Yeah.
I am very much at home. This is where I got started.
Since that morning in 2016, I've had the rhythm and the message of this Trinity Church choir in my head. The choir sang, "Call him up and tell him what you want." It's a small choir, only 4 singers, but a big sound. When you're lonely, when you're sick, when you're troubled, call him up and tell him what you want. This lead singer that you're hearing is Pauline Thomas. We met with her after church, and she told us that she knew Curly Hall. She knew A.C. Hall.
He played ball with my brothers, all of them, you know, hung out together. We had the basketball goal and everything, the baseball things, and that's where we played all of it. But it was...
In the absence of a eulogy for A.C. Hall from his funeral on that October 18th, 1962, I think I'm going to let Pauline Thomas's words stand as a substitute.
He was raised very well, and... His mother and grandmother catered.
Okay.
You know, he was just, I say, spoiled in a good way. He was what you call the livelihood fella.
Lively.
He liked to keep things, you know, going and make everybody laugh. He was just, he was a sweet kid.
Pauline said she attended AC's funeral. Now, almost 60 years later, she doesn't recall the details of the service, but she does remember one thing. All the folks in the church,
cried so hard. I can't say for certain, but I have found what I believe is the most likely route for the funeral procession. The hearse carrying the body of A.C. Hall left the church and drove within shouting distance of his home, not too far from George Washington Carver School, past Macon Hospital, past the Middle Georgia Veterans Club on Cotton Avenue, past that Confederate monument, over the Ocmulgee River, and then to a sprawling cemetery in Macon, Woodlawn. At some point after that day, the funeral home covered his gravesite with a stone slab. Then they placed a small headstone on top. At the foot of the slab are these words, "At rest." The day after A.C. Hall's funeral, we're back in the courthouse in the courtroom for the coroner's inquest, day two. Eloise Franklin is back on the stand. Prosecutor Jack Gautier has just one more question for her, and it's a big one.
Did you or did you not at any time see a revolver or weapon on A.C. Hall at the Middle Georgia Veterans Club or at any time you were walking from there to the direction of the school grounds?
No, I did not.
Now, I'd like you to hear some things Eloise told a friend of hers many years later. That friend is Ollie Mae Hutchins. I spoke to Mrs. Hutchins in her home in Macon. She didn't know Eloise back in 1962 when all this happened. The two of them lived next door for more than 15 years, but that wasn't until the late 1990s. The two of them would get together from time to time just to, well, in Ollie's words, have a little nip. And they would talk. Even in her 50s, Eloise was still speaking about A.C. Hall, especially about how the police treated her the night of the shooting.
But she kept saying, "He ain't got no gun. He ain't got no gun." And no matter how much she kept saying that, she said they didn't pay her no attention. And she said they kept trying to force her to say things that wasn't true.
Eloise told Ollie Mae Hutchins something else, her theory about the reason A.C. was shot that night. According to Hutchins, Eloise Franklin was so light-skinned that she could almost pass for white. And Eloise theorized that the police shot A.C. Hall because they mistakenly believed that he was alone in the dark with a white girl.
And she had pretty long black hair. And a black guy was walking with her. So she said that she think they probably thought the black guy was with the white woman. But she said when they find out she wasn't white, and she told them he didn't do it, they didn't believe nothing she said.
By the way, this storyline that A.C. Hall was killed because he was with a white woman, which we can neither prove nor disprove, is something we'd heard before, at the church, Trinity CME, during our visits there. Now let's go back to the coroner's inquest. Eloise Franklin is still on the stand. Howard Moore is still asking the questions. First, he underscores her testimony that the police shouted no warnings before they opened fire.
You have testified that A.C. ran past the police car.
That's right.
And that the police car stopped. Is that right?
That's right.
And that the policeman who was driving got out of the car.
That's right.
And that he did not holler or make any remark. He did not holler, "Stop."
No.
Did he holler, "Halt"?
No.
Did he say, "Come here"?
No.
Did he say anything else?
No.
What did he do?
The police?
Yes.
He starts shooting.
Did he shoot in the air?
No.
Do you know in which direction he shot?
He shooted straight at AC.
He was shooting straight at AC.
Yes.
Eloise Franklin is finally allowed to step down. The next two witnesses help us track the movements of AC and Eloise on the night of the shooting. One witness had been at the Veterans Club where AC and Eloise set out. The other witness lived at the end of that route, near the Carver School, and says he was watching TV and heard the shots. Now, we've all seen enough true crime on television to know how important physical evidence can be. But so, too, is the timeline. That first witness at the Veterans Club was bartender Jeff Perkins. He said he knew AC and Eloise and was even standing by the door when they left. Based on the testimony of Jeff Perkins, AC and Eloise left the club at about 9:15 that night. And from the inquest, we've learned that Doris Hopper got home from the shrimp boat and saw that man getting out of her husband's car at about 9:30. So, could A.C. Hall have left the Veterans Club around 9:15 and been ransacking the Hopper's car at 9:30? Well, it depends on how long it takes A.C. Hall to get from the Veterans Club past the Carver School to the Hopper home. I'm going to step you through this, and I'll concede there are a lot of numbers, but these numbers are important. I've walked from the club to the school several times. That takes me about 20 minutes, and I walk pretty fast. And these kids were probably not walking fast. They were ambling. So let's say it took them 25 minutes to get to the school, 5 minutes longer than it would take me. It means they'd have arrived at the Carver School at 9:40. But the Hopper's home was beyond the school, maybe by 3, 4, even 5 minutes. Which means that the soonest AC could have arrived at the Hopper home is 9:43. And remember, Doris Hopper arrived at 9:30. So we're working through all this, and we go to talk to David Davis, the current sheriff of Macon-Bibb County. I'd given him the transcript of the inquest. And when we spoke, it was obvious that he'd read it from cover to cover and developed his own thoughts and analysis.
But you got to think about it. These are folks, they're walking, they're strolling. They're just walking home. So you're not going to be in such a big rush. I'm sure AC is probably wanting to walk with this girl as slowly as he can because he's probably wanting, you know, they sort of kind of friends, so... You know, he knows if he gets her to her friend girl, he's not going to have her to himself.
So what time was AC shot? Well, that's where the second witness comes in, and his name was Ed Carvest. He's the one I'd mentioned earlier, who said he was watching TV when he heard the shots. Carvest was a leader in the black community. Incidentally, the celebrated jazz singer and actress Lena Horne, who lived for a period of time in the Tyndall Heights area, credited Ed Carvest with starting her musical career when he arranged for her black youth choir to sing at Macon City Hall. So he's called to testify because he heard the gunshots and he can help fix the time that they occurred. After Carvest testifies that he heard 7 shots, Denmark Groover takes over the questioning.
Were you in your house or outside?
I was in my house.
Had you gone to bed at that time?
No.
Were you watching television?
I was looking at the television and eating supper.
Now A.R. King jumps in. He's the coroner, the man presiding over the inquest. He wants to know what was on television that night.
I don't know if it was Gunsmoke or Defenders or what's that other one? Have Gun, Will Travel. Was one of those 3 programs on at the time.
Have Gun, Will Travel. You know, we did what we got to do. We checked the TV listings in the Macon Telegraph's archive for October 13th, 1962, Well, sure enough, Have Gun Will Travel was on at 9:30. Gunsmoke at 10. Groover asks a couple of more questions.
And you counted 7 shots?
I did.
Did any of them come out of the television?
No.
Groover now passes the witness to attorney Howard Moore.
What time did this happen? What time did you hear the shots?
I'd say around 10 o'clock.
This testimony helps bookend the timeline. AC left the club at about 9:15, shots fired at around 9:45. And there's one more time we're sure of that night. Coroner A.R. King signed AC Hall's death report at 10:05 p.m. Now look, okay, I suppose it's possible that A.C. Hall raced from the Veterans Club to the Hopper's car and stole the gun, and then raced to the schoolyard in time to be discovered by the police. But only if he left Eloise behind, and only if Eloise then walked the streets of Macon by herself to meet A.C. at the school. And only if Eloise was lying on the stand about, well, everything. And only if the police had found the Hopper's gun at the scene of AC's shooting. Are you seeing what I'm seeing? There's just a lot of ifs here, and they're just not supported by the timeline. So here's what I'm thinking. I'm not buying it. There's just no way that AC Hall stole that missing gun. Next on Buried Truths, we'll hear from a critically important witness, the owner of that gun, Barnett Hopper.
Right after he passed the mound of dirt, he had turned and his right arm was coming out from his right side.
Buried Truths is a production of WAVE Atlanta. There are a lot of ways you can get more connected to the work we're doing. Sign up for our newsletter at wabe.org/buriedtruths. You'll get historic photos, documents, and more info about the case. Bring Buried Truths into the classroom by downloading lesson plans for middle and high school students, and follow us on social media. We're at Buried Truths Podcast. And of course, as always, please subscribe if you haven't already and leave us a review. It'll help others find this show. If you have any information related to this case, write or send a voice memo to hank@buriedtruths.org. Hank Klibanoff is a former newspaper reporter and editor and co-author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Race Beat. Today, he's a professor at Emory University. The Buried Truths team includes David Bereswain, Richard Hallix, Catherine Dautrick, Marilyn Gwax, J.N. Berry, and Christine Dempsey. The actors in this episode included Matt Nitschy, Freddie Ashley, Isoke Akonke, and Daviar Snipes. Thanks to Emory University and its Centers for Digital Scholarship and Faculty Excellence. And another big thanks to the nearly 100 students who've taken the Civil Rights Cold Cases class that Hank Klibanoff teaches at Emory. And thank you for listening to Buried Truths.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The world is full of mysteries. Are ghosts real? Is that yogurt expired? Hey, the unknown can be scary, but when you donate to WABE, you know where your money is going. Your gift supports the journalism that keeps you informed and the programs that pull back the curtain on complicated stories. Help us make the world less mysterious. Become a member now. Go online to wabe.org/donate, and thanks.